So I'm really pleased to be joined here today with Blair and Dave. And these two folks right here, you heard their questions from the audience before. They are definitely notorious players in the policy landscape. Lots of great history here. I'm gonna let them introduce themselves, but Blair has truly been involved in so many aspects of Medicare and federal policy, federal health policy. And just, you'll hear in a moment, it's quite a list. And Dave is a longtime healthcare investment banker and now an advisor. They both have lots to share and really interesting backgrounds. So Blair, why don't you go ahead and give a brief introduction for the
sure.
audience?
Sure, thanks. Am I on? Can you all hear? Yeah, so Blair Childs, I have been working in healthcare policy for 40 years, and I know I look very young, but and I've really been in all the major issue areas over that time. So I have a very long perspective, but I ran, it was interesting, AJ mentioned earlier, the Harry and Louise program. I don't know if anybody remembers that. I ran that. I also led the effort that led to Medicare Advantage. It was at that time Medicare Plus.
So you single-handedly?
Yeah, I ran the campaigns for both of those.
So you defeated Hillary Care.
Yeah, well, we didn't, wow. It was very tough when the Clinton administration came after us, that's for sure. And then I've also was involved in drafting the ACO provisions, value-based care provisions in the ACA. And also all of the opening up of the EHRs, which has been a huge problem, as I think many of you know. So I've been super involved in all these areas, playing a leadership role and understanding the policy. So I have a real sweep of experience. So thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
I gotta say, the Harry and Louise ads, if you haven't seen them, that was brilliant. Not sure I necessarily agreed with the objective, but it was brilliant. Application of how to sway public opinion. So
it was a first of its kind.
Yeah. So Dave Johnson, I've got an unusual background. I was an English literature major in college and then a Peace Corps volunteer in Africa, lived through a coup, thought I wanted to have a career in international development, but thought I needed some skills. So I got a public policy degree at Harvard at the Kennedy School, when it was far and away the most quantitative professional program at Harvard. Almost killed me, but I learned to love economics, statistics, econometrics, analytic modeling, that type of thing. And through some twists and turns, ultimately became a healthcare investment banker to large nonprofit health systems, which would have surprised no one more than my own Peace Corps self. So the reason I tell you that background is, so I had a very successful investment banking career, funding $30 billion of tax-exempt bond issues to build hospitals, ambulatory centers, so on. Put together many of the largest systems in the country and so on. But by 2014, I just couldn't do it anymore. I felt I was contributing to the overbuilding of the acute care footprint in the country. And then the question was what to do next. And so I hired a coach, a former hockey player, and it became a full contact sport. He would call me on my bullshit, I would fight back, and anyway, the last session, probably the best money I ever spent, by the way, but the last session, he came in, loaded for bear, and said, you want to write a book, you think you got something to say. And I told him he was crazy, except in a lot more colorful language than that. It was supposed to be a session, it was a Friday afternoon, an hour session, a Friday afternoon. Hour went by, hour and a half. We got to 2 hours, and he basically said, I'm not gonna leave until you tell me you're gonna give this serious consideration. And I wanted to go home, so I said, sure, I'll think about it. And over the weekend, I was thinking about it, and I said, well, what if he's right? Got over myself a little bit. Why would anybody care what I have to say? And then I thought about my background, and I'd been doing a little bit of writing, and I said, maybe it takes some combination of cultural sensitivity, like you get in the Peace Corps, literary sensibility, like you get being a literature major, public policy acumen, and market expertise to make sense of this, and I can look at the industry from all four of those lenses. Maybe I'll see some things that others don't. And anyway, that's what led to the launch of Foresight Health, and 11 years later of meeting payroll, five books later, you know, we're going forward. And I spend all of my time thinking about how to fix the broken healthcare system, and my own perspective is market-driven reform. So policy's interesting, it's important, but I think bottom-up is how the system's gonna change more than top-down.
Yeah, so maybe you're not totally in disagreement. There are some things you might agree on.
No, I suspect everybody in this room is focused on fixing healthcare.
Yes, that's true. Well, let's talk about the marketplace, where we are right now. We're recording this in, I want to say, October, near Washington, D.C. The government is shut down. We just learned about, you know, really significant cuts coming to Medicaid and generally to the sector. You know, how are you both seeing the marketplace starting to, trying to, reacting, adapting? It's been, you know, a few weeks, a month or so here since we learned about these large cuts and are watching this all happen. What do you think's happening? How's the market responding?
Do you want to start?
All right, Dave. I'll start. One of the things I've been thinking about for a while, this is even before the shutdown, is the extent to which these massive cuts are going to be a forcing function of sorts. There's this concept in business called constrained optimization. So if you have fewer resources, how can you get more out of it? And one of the interesting things about the Big Beautiful Bill is every healthcare association in the country was screaming at the top of its lungs not to do this. And the Trump administration barely shrugged its shoulders and went ahead. And it got me wondering whether the industry has cried crisis one too many times. And if we're in this sort of forced period of constrained optimization, how is that gonna work its way out? Well, I also happen to believe that US healthcare might be the single most inefficient industry in the history of humanity. I'll give you one example. So in industry, there's this concept of production capacity. So an assembly line conceivably can be running 168 hours a week. So 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you have to have time out for restocking the line. Sometimes it goes down. But a good percentage is in the high 80s to low 90%. So think about your typical OR inside healthcare, right? And runs typically one shift a day, 4.5 days a week. At best, its production capacity percentage is 25%. Now, I happen to have been in my career, I was on the board of a health system in India called Medanta. We ran our ORs 7 days a week, probably 20 plus hours a day. I mean, it's a really expensive resource. So if this industry ever sort of adopted the tenets of manufacturing, which is basically what surgery is, we would operate in very different ways than we currently do. So there's enormous capacity to be sort of taken out, or costs to be taken out of the system to operate more efficiently. And that's even before we get to the fact that all of our resources go toward treatment and very little goes toward prevention. So my sense is from the market, and the Big Beautiful Bill is part of this, I guess, but we are on this journey where the industry has been unable to make the changes to drive better outcomes, lower costs, better customer experience. And 10 years ago when I started, or 11 years ago when I started Foresight, I thought the industry could change from the inside out. I now believe that change is coming outside in, and it's gonna be messy, and there'll be a lot of casualties. So what we're talking about here with Innovacer and population health and being able to more effectively allocate resources to make our population healthier, more productive, happier, is exactly the right conversation to have. And I would tell the health systems in the audience, insurance companies, incumbents broadly, either you kind of get on board with the idea that value and consumerism are going to be what differentiates new companies in the marketplace, or get ready to become less relevant in the world that's coming.
Yeah, think of all those empty MRIs. Really expensive empty MRIs.
Yeah.
So let me ask this. How many people feel like they understand what's going on in D.C.? Just raise your hand. You do. Very impressive. I mean, I love the comment that was made earlier about clicks, mouse clicks lead to clarity, I think. I can't remember who said that.
Brandon said that, maybe.
Brandon, but you know, what exists in Washington is mouse clicks lead to a lack of clarity because there's so much energy, confusion, you know, hyperbolic, because what you're trying to do when you read the press or anything that's talking about Washington is get people to click on the article. So it's actually creating more confusion. But when you peel things back in what's going on here, totally agree with the constraint on spending, on money. Totally agree that is one of Trump's in this administration, the trifecta. We have to talk about the trifecta. So you've got a unified Republican Congress and of course, the presidency.
Unified is doing a lot of work in that sense.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Keep going.
Well, actually, it's amazing that what this Congress has done with, you know, 2-3-4 vote majority. It's unbelievable. And the speed, I've never seen anything like this. I've been working in this area for so long, and I've never seen anything move this fast. So I will tell you where Donald Trump comes from in all this, having spent time with the guy. He is all about one thing, which is how do we reduce healthcare spending? That's really his focus. And he doesn't know anything more about how to do that other than the fact that we've got to do that. So there's essentially what's going on is a full court press by this administration and by this Congress to try to bring down healthcare spending. So there's no party that isn't being attacked to some extent. The payers are having to deal with audits and with this new HCC coding methodology, which was started actually in Trump 1. Pharmaceutical companies, or we all know about MF, you know, most favored nation and other kinds of things that are out there. Health systems, clearly with Medicaid cuts, the Medicaid cuts really hit at the health systems overall. All these things are going on, and then you've got on top of that, so you've got the constrained resources and cuts, which are not something that Republicans generally advocate for. They're more market-based, but I think they're doing major control changes. So literally cutting
tax cuts some way, right?
Literally cutting payment, literally making mandatory payment models. So in Trump 1, we didn't talk about mandatory payment models. In fact, they went back from having a mandatory
model. That was a bad word. It was very controversial to have a mandatory model.
They're now, you're going to see more of that coming forward overall. So there's an impatience, there's a speed of change, and all that's going on. And I just think what you guys are doing in this room, what I've heard from Innovacer here, it is so spot on in terms of what you've got to do, which is harness technology to understand the data and then put it to use, fits with what I see going on overall in healthcare. And I've been looking at this for so long and working on this for so long. One is that we are moving from a government-designed healthcare system, because it was the way it was built, was in the 1960s. You had Medicare and Medicaid, and it's got all its arcane mechanics behind it. Fee for service, which has misaligned incentives. I don't need to tell anybody in this room that. But fee for service is basically a government designed system, and it was designed by, for all practical purposes, Congress plus providers, because all the different provider groups were at the table. And that's how it was built initially.
Don't forget the Blue Cross Associations who got to administer.
True. Although initially CMS ran all of Medicare, of course. They contracted out, but they ran all of Medicare. And the states really had their own agencies that ran Medicaid. So we're moving from this government design system to a more market-based system. And the market-based system is shifting this public risk, which is Medicare or Medicaid, to a private entity that is responsible for the cost of care, total cost of care. That's where we are going. It's just, it's unmistakable, it's very clear. We've been talking about it here. And, you know, the providers in a position are in a position of having all the data and really being able to harness it to improve care. And so the health systems are really well positioned in this. The problem is they have a hard time getting out of their own way, because we've got this system that we have to live with on a day-to-day basis. So that's one of the major trends that's going on. It's shifting public risk to private entities who are accountable for cost and quality and outcomes, like what you guys were talking about. That's one thing. The second thing is they're basically dismantling or changing all the perverse incentives that exist in fee-for-service that undermine competition. So that's everything from 340B, which really discriminates against for-profit hospitals and not-for-profit hospitals. You've got, obviously, different payment levels depending on your site of care. So that's the site-neutral payment kinds of things. There's obviously access to data and so forth, that you your transparency of pricing information, all those things. So those are all the competitive things that this administration is trying to take on and address that undermine robust competition. So that you're going to see more of that is that movement. And then the last thing is something we've been talking about a lot here, which is consumerism. And, you know, that's patient access to data themselves, their own personal health record. There's a big focus of that in this administration. It's price transparency in that area, too. It's all the quality metrics and making those as transparent and taking it down to the individual clinician level. All these things are, these are the three big buckets of policy focus going on in Washington that have been underway for, frankly, decades. I mean, that's a large part of what I've been working on over my career, is trying to realign the incentives so that you can fix healthcare. But if you think in terms of those areas, shifting public risk and what that means and how that plays out, this whole creating greater competition, a market-based competition in the system, which right now is undermined by a lot of different policies, and then also how do you empower patients? So that's what I see going on overall.
I want to kind of amplify on the market side of this, because you and I are in violent agreement here on what's happening. So I shameless plug, but I just published last November the Coming Healthcare Revolution with Paul Kusserow, and our punchline is more change in the next 10 years than in the last 100 years. It's a megatrends book, massive macroeconomic forces pushing down on the largest industry ever created by human beings, starting to crack it. And markets hate a void, so market forces pushing up to fill that, and it's big enough. So what are the force multipliers that are going to change, as I said, the largest industry ever built by human beings? Healthcare is pushing towards $6 trillion. That's almost 25% bigger than the economy of Germany. So only the United States and China are bigger than the healthcare economy. And not only do we have the largest industry ever created by human beings, we also have the largest industrial complex ever created by human beings. And those of you who remember Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex, the conjunction of industry, bureaucracy, and Congress legislative bodies working for their interests at the expense of broader society, we have that on steroids in healthcare. So in 60, when Eisenhower gave that speech, military, believe it or not, was 9% of the economy. Today it's 3%. We have a massive military industrial complex. Healthcare was 5, and now it's 18. And we have these groups working together at the federal level and the state level, really for their own benefit at the expense of broader society. So why should it change, right? And it's been hard to change because the constituents are so powerful. They have captured the legislative and regulatory process. Well, I think there are three force multipliers, and they overlap with what Blair was saying. The first is just better buying. We have enormous monopoly and monopsony pricing power at the regional levels. And large employers, governments and so on, that basically pay premium prices for commodity services haven't been able to overcome that. But there are a whole host of things happening that are enabling better buying. So that's going to drive toward value. The second one, and we spent a lot of time on this today, is liberated data. Data wants to be free. It wants to flow to where it will have the greatest value. And we have had active suppression of data. We talk about fragmentation silos. It's to the benefit of incumbents. And that's starting to get blown away. And I hope Innovacer is one of the ones doing that. And then the final force is the one that Blair mentioned, which is consumerism. And again, I believe the companies that solve the jobs to be done of end users, sometimes called patients, sometimes called consumers, sometimes called customers, they've been largely neglected by the system as a whole. But the organizations that figure out how to solve the health and healthcare needs of end users in a way that creates value are going to be the ones that win. And I'm just tired of talking about it. It's hard for me to go to conferences. I've got this phrase I was telling Lisa. It's MAFA, M-A-F-A. It stands for mistaking articulation for accomplishment. It is rife in healthcare. Enough already. Let's fix the problem.
Yeah. So all the talkers.
Just a moment. I want to talk a little bit more about the data side, because each of you separately have spoken a lot about the need for data to be free, so to speak, to not be locked up in systems.
Libre data.
Right. Yeah. In fact, the Trump administration had Data Liberation Day, just as a side note. You've each talked about this separately at different times and coming at it from slightly different perspectives, right? And I think it's interesting that each of you in your careers and your areas of focus also got to the same place of the data needs to be liberated, the data needs to be free so that folks can use it to improve the health of populations, you know, be successful truly in value-based care. So talk a little bit about that. We want to save some time to talk about Medicare Advantage, so don't spend too much time on it, but give me a little bit more, Blair, on your perspective here.
I'll start off on that. So it's pretty interesting. You guys all know how we got our EHR system, right? Do you remember the shovel-ready programs back in 2009, 2010? I guess it was 2009. So the money went to the vendors. They made a lot of money through that. You had to have an EHR, and the penalties went to the providers. Okay. You talk about a misaligned set of incentives. Imagine having a requirement that you have to use your product to succeed. And that's basically what the EHRs had. And of course, then they put a wall around their data, and it made it very difficult for folks to get into it. So that was one of the things I worked really hard on. I was threatened by Epic. I mentioned this to Dave. I mean, literally threatened by Epic. Because we were trying to open up the EHRs so that you could, open APIs, application programming interfaces. So that was a radical idea, and this is where the problem we have in healthcare, of course, the government's in the middle of it, so we had to get Congress to pass a bill. Look at the standoff that's going on right now. They can't open the government because they can't agree. So this was trying to get a bill passed when people didn't really even understand what an API was. So it was incredibly challenging, but this is what is happening now. It required that kind of change. It underscores the realities we face in healthcare, which is the government's in the middle of it, and it makes it really hard because partly the government, no members of Congress want to make a tough decision, period. That is, you can take that home. I guarantee you that's the way it is. They don't like to make any decisions because that's a risk. And that's why the fact that they just passed this bill, the OBA, in 6 months is absolutely extraordinary. And it just gives you a sense of what's coming. And so again, what you all are doing to try to get ahead of that, and we can talk more about it, but ultimately, it's managing patient populations, because I agree there was a question asked earlier by somebody, or I guess Dave, you mentioned what's your takeaway? You were asking your panel, what should everybody be thinking about? And it really is this notion that you've got to make the patients that you're serving really want to come back to you. And that involves all the using their data, understanding all those things, providing them services that are the best. That's ultimately what we're going to have to compete around. So anyway, that's long-winded. Yeah, we need to get data access. It's been going on for a long time to get there. It's required literally a law in Congress to get there. But it is underway, and this administration is going to do everything in their power to provide greater access to that data, particularly to consumers.
This is 21st Century Cures and the no information blocking rules, just for clarity.
Right.
Plenty of laws.
So we've had some audience participation this morning, so I'm going to do three quick questions. Just raise your hand, yes or no. So the U.S. spends 18% of its economy on healthcare. The next big countries with the next highest percentages are France and Germany at 12%. Anybody here think we need to spend more than 18% of our economy to deliver great health care to everyone in the country?
Seeing no hands.
No hands, okay.
You gotta have one where we can, some people can raise their
hand. You'll see, it's a setup.
Okay.
So according to the CDC, while they still exist, over 90% of healthcare spending goes to treat individuals with chronic disease and or mental health conditions. How many think we're winning the war against chronic disease and mental health conditions?
I'm also not no hands. Seeing
okay.
any hands.
Okay. Third question. Third question. On a relative basis, then, how many believe we need to transfer resources out of acute and specialty care into primary care, health promotion, chronic disease management, and behavioral health?
All right, I'm
Everybody.
Seeing almost every
so
single hand.
Okay. It's not the what to do, it's the how to do it. We know what we do. What did we learn in that exercise? It's not a funding question, it's a distribution challenge. We're not attacking our biggest need, which is exploding chronic disease and mental health conditions, and we need major restructuring. So this gets to your data element. We need data to drive more effective allocation of resources. We need more investment in primary care, in health promotion, in chronic disease management. If we did a better job on the front end, we wouldn't need as much on the back end. I said it last night in my question. As a system, we do a great job on rescuing people when they're drowning, but we don't teach them how to swim. We get that equation absolutely wrong. So data to inform decisions that isn't constrained by incumbents doing things that work for their benefit, not for the people as a whole. And that's the revolution. That's the coming healthcare revolution. And everybody raise your fist, hand, close your fist, repeat after me, raise your hand.
Oh, we're
close
making
your
a,
fist,
a yeah, pledge is
and
coming.
Say, revolution, baby, let's
no,
do it.
No. Don't implicate yourselves,
yeah.
It's all good.
Did you take a picture of that?
Yeah, exactly. Take a picture of that one. Blair is saying revolutionary.
I have to say, listening to the discussions here today, you guys are involved in a revolution.
Nice.
And so keep it up.
Nice.
By the way, sacred cows make the best hamburger. So
okay.
That
okay.
Innovacer is going to be doing a lot of barbecues as we go forward.
We are, of course, already running short on time, but I want to make sure we get a chance to talk about Medicare Advantage and ACOs. I think it's a really important topic, also likely to be very controversial here. I think we've seen some real structural differences between MA and ACOs on the policy side, the funding side, the profitability side. Let's talk about this difference. I want to start with you, Blair, because you were definitely very deeply involved in creating Medicare Advantage. You know, from where you were then to where we are today, you know, talk about this difference and where you see it going from here.
Yeah, so there's, I think most people, I can go through sort of the details of it, but there's big differences between the way the ACO program, the traditional Medicare, you guys all know the traditional fee-for-service Medicare and how it's structured, and fee-for-service and so forth, and how they built the through the ACA, the ACOs, and how they need to operate. So all the rules that are around that. And they basically had to force feed, you know, attribute patients to an ACO, then risk stratify them and so forth. And there's different sets of rules that apply to the ACOs from MA plans. And this creates an uneven playing field, but this administration will be trying to make it more level, frankly, in a variety of ways. As I said earlier, this is, they're attacking everybody. They're attacking the MA plans in terms of their revenue as well as the health systems and what's going on with Medicaid and all. Everybody is, there's no sacred cows out there overall. But the rules are different. It's made it difficult for ACOs to succeed. At the same time, we will always have a traditional Medicare population, and it will need to be better managed overall. And whether this is because they do the wiser automated prior authorization program for traditional Medicare, are you guys aware of that?
We're aware of it.
Yeah. So whether it's that, there's a ASC, surgery center, prior authorization program that was just announced. So those are things to try to contain the perverse incentives in fee-for-service. So there's just a lot of things being done from a policy vantage point, and that this administration will keep trying to implement to address the lack of competition or the uneven playing fields that exist. So they exist. They're going to be taken on. This administration, I keep saying this, I don't want to sound positive about this administration because it's going to create a lot of pain. But they're going to do, they're going to break glass, because Washington hasn't broken glass in the past, because they've been, it's just been very, very cautious. It just, for all the dynamics I described. And this administration, I mean, I saw it in the first Trump administration, but they're going to be much, much more aggressive, and you're going to see things like site-neutral payment. You already have seen it. You're going to see the elimination of the inpatient-only list, which is, it's already going on, which is, has created an advantage for inpatient hospitals. They're going to do something about 340B. We can talk about what those elements are, which is a huge revenue source for health systems. But it's uneven because the for-profits can't play in 340B, and so there's this big debate that goes on there. So yeah, I get the different expressions, because for-profits versus not-for-profits, and that's a whole other debate that goes on. But these are all the things that, from a policy vantage point, are going on. My view overall is that Medicare Advantage is going to continue to grow. It's going to outpace traditional Medicare. You need to work with those MA plans, and the smart health systems are doing that. So they're taking their skills that they're learning from their ACOs, and they're applying them to their work with the for-profit or, in some cases, not-for-profit MA plans. But I don't see any diminution or movement away from MA overall.
Yeah. Well, Blair and Lisa are both much better than I am on the details of all the initial programs. What I will tell you, what I love about Medicare Advantage is that once you get through the risk coding, you actually have to manage the care of a population. What I hate about Medicare Advantage is all of the effort goes into the risk scoring. I'm wearing one of my favorite ties today, which is egg and chicken. Which came first? Chicken or the egg? And I want to get some healthcare specific ones. Upcoding versus denials, volume versus value, health versus healthcare. There are just some fundamental contradictions built into the system. And I really felt badly for the pop health panels that were up on stage trying to explain how they work inside these large provider organizations to actually think about population health. This is a truth. Take it home to the bank. Competing on health is fundamentally different than competing on healthcare. We actually need to do both a lot better. Clay Christensen has this concept of dual transformation. Transformation A is the existing business. Healthcare, how do we deliver better outcomes, lower cost, better customer service? Huge amount of work there. Health, which is the kind of the B, the new thing, over time, we need to make more investments in health so that can get bigger and more robust so we can spend less on A, but we need to do both better. I can't imagine who pays a psychiatrist for the people doing population health inside health systems. I mean, the health systems don't do that great a job of doing what they're supposed to do. Why should we expect them to solve the health problem as well? You know, it's so coming back to MA and so on, we need to shift the way we pay for care in order to change the way we deliver care, which gets us to risk-based payment. The industry has fought this mightily. The AMA, since its foundation, had said the two tenets that are you can't change are fee-for-service payment and individual choice of physician. Well, guess what, folks? That doesn't work. So we're going to have to, as I say, you know, kill some sacred cows along the way. But that's what's happening, and the change that's coming, again, is more outside in than inside out, and I couldn't agree with you more. It's happening, and it's going to be messy.
Okay, we are really almost out of time, so we're going to
give you... You're kidding.
I know.
We're just getting started.
We're going to give you... you got 30 seconds to give your sort of final takeaway for this audience about the policy landscape over the next year and change. All right, Blair, you're up.
30 seconds.
Yeah, 30 seconds. Okay, it's... I've already said it in many ways. It's... You're going to see a lot of change, a lot of pressure, financial pressure. It's already been done through this Medicaid bill. It's going to also be done through a number of other smaller changes. And so the forcing function of that you were talking about, David, is absolutely the case. And it's going to mean, if you think about what you're doing with an ACO or some kind of a value-based program, you're basically trying to lock, you're locking in a price point when you're going to have a system that is forcing costs down. And the overall, all these reforms, site-neutral payment, if you're already got your benchmark and they do site-neutral payment and you get payment cuts, you will profit by having a risk-based model. Do you follow me? Do people understand what I'm saying? Yes, you do. Somebody does.
Seeing some hands.
So that is what's going on and where things are going, and it's an imperative, I think, for organizations to be moving to risk, moving to value-based purchasing kinds of programs. And I'm just super impressed that Innovacer is focusing on that as sort of its core guiding light.
Okay, 30 seconds.
You can do it.
When Paul and I were writing the book, we came up with this acronym, CB2E2. Sounds like Star Wars, right? C stands for cheaper. First B stands for better. Second B stands for more balanced, as in more balanced between health and healthcare, like we were just talking about. First E is easier. Second E is empowering for caregivers and for consumers. I'm now evaluating private companies, and you're all private companies in here, on the extent to which you do CB2E2. So if you take one thing out of this call, take that acronym, go back to your companies, and have the honest conversation. Are we actually cheaper, better, more balanced, easier, and empowering? And if you're not, change what you're doing.
That's great. Well, on that note, join me in thanking my incredible panel here. Really appreciate you. Yeah. And thanks, everyone, for coming, to our customers, to our partners, and the incredible Innovacer team.